You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Attention, Retronauts listeners. Do not skip this very important announcement. This Sunday, October 18th, from 5 to 7 p.m., we'll be renting out the Great Arcade Ground Control in Portland for a private Retronauts meetup. And even though we'll be in town to attend the Portland Retro Games Expo, you won't need to be an attendee of that event to come to our party. Oh yeah, and did I mention it's free? That's right. It's free! So if you'd like to join us for 2 hours of fun in a two-story arcade full of classic games and Retronauts fans, all you need to do is RSVP by October 16th, 2015 by going to tinyurl.com/retronautsparty. That's tinyurl.com/retronautsparty. And we'll also have a link to this registration page on our Facebook page, so please join that if you haven't. It'll be pinned to the top until the event happens. Once again, that's Ground Control, control with a K, in Portland, Oregon on October 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. So please go to tinyurl.com/retronautsparty and make sure you RSVP by October 16th. And we hope to see you there. And just remember, it's free! This week on Retronauts, we learn the many mysteries of Puff Puff. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of Retronauts. This is your host, Bob Mackey, and today's episode is Dragon Quest, or rather, it's about Dragon Quest. But before I continue, let's find out who else is in the room. Who's across from me right now?
It's me, Jeremy Parrish.
That's awesome. And who else do we have?
This be Henry Gilbert.
Oh, yes. I guess we all need very, like, impenetrable accents if this is going
to
be a Dragon Quest
episode. I tried to say that, like,
I will talk in the Russian accent.
I'm afraid of offending any other cultures other than white people, so
Russians are very white. They're whiter than us.
I guess so.
Caucasian? Hence the white Russian.
That's true. So, yes, we're going to be talking about Dragon Quest today, and we have done an episode in the past, but I believe that was 2008, and a lot has changed, especially in terms of what games that we've received and what games we haven't.
Yes, but, back in 2008, they were actually localizing Dragon Quest games.
It's all gone for the worst.
It was part of, like, the American Dragon Quest Renaissance that was very short-lived, maybe, like, five years almost, but... we can talk about that sad state of things later. Let's talk about where Dragon Quest came from. And before I do that, I want to talk about the key figures behind this series. And there's really three guys associated with this series. And the first one, of course, is Yuji Horii, who was born in 1954, and he was originally a freelance writer, including a weekly column for Shonen Jump magazine.
Are we doing, like, the full bio here?
Yeah.
Wow.
I want everyone to know all about Yuji Horii and where he came from, because, like,
he went to downtown high school.
His favorite food is cigarettes.
The Crosstown High, home of the generic gang.
Yes.
I believe he went there, yes. But I mean, it's not – I'm not going to give the whole account of his life, but it's important to know that like all these people are connected with Shonen Jump in some way, or at least the main figures. So Hori had a column about video games in Shonen Jump magazine, and if you're not aware of what that is, it's basically a very, very popular comics magazine that – prints things about comics and games and things like that. We don't have an equivalent of that over here, although I believe there is a version of Shonen Jump here still.
That's still published? Yeah, I don't think it still exists.
I know they try to sell it to me digitally because I have the Viz manga app, but I'm not sure if it's still on store shelves. But it's essentially like a phone book size brick of manga and things about games and stuff like that.
It comes out every week. It's a phone book every week.
Can you imagine that? Oh,
that sounded like a dream. In 1996, when I first heard about that, I was like, this sounds like a dream.
Yeah.
Japan has everything good.
It's the greatest place on earth.
Comics just fall from the sky in giant phone books.
Someday I'm going to be Japanese when I grow up.
So what happened here was there was a game contest sponsored by the company Enix. And Yuji Horii was a budding programmer, and he entered a game called Love Match Tennis, and that eventually placed in the contest. And from then, he developed Portopia, three Portopia games essentially for Enix before working on Dragon Quest. And reading about Enix, it's strange. It's like they're not a video game company explicitly. They just contract people to make them games. So there's no like in team.
They like, publish stuff, but they always hire an outside developer.
Yeah, so I'm sure like Horii was contracted to do Portopia, and they like paid him. I think it was like a royalty system. I was reading.
Yeah, something along those lines.
I read that's why they did game contests back in the day. It's similar to like. Going back to manga and Shonen Jump, they'd say, let's do a contest. Instead of just taking open submissions, let's make it a contest.
It's an easy way to, I guess, crowdsource or like have other people do some work that you don't want to do maybe in some
cases.
Back
in the 80s.
Well, I mean, Enix exists as a publisher. We tend to conflate publishers and developers, but they were always just a company that published games.
Yeah.
That was always their purpose was to take other people's creations and give them a clearinghouse. I mean, you don't see a lot of that in the mainstream games industry, but definitely in the indie space, there's, you know, a lot of companies like Nicolas and
formerly Midnight City. Was what they wanted to do.
How about like Xseed?
Yeah, no, Xseed is tied to Marvelous.
Okay, so.
Atlas USA does a lot of indie publishing.
But Atlas still has an in-house first-party development.
Yeah.
You see a lot of that in the indie space, and the company names are escaping me right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm stupid.
I guess it took until me writing these notes to realize like what Enix really was. And like if you look at the history of Dragon Quest, like the games have essentially like four or five different developers that are just like hired under the direction of Yuji Horii to make these games, including Level 5.
Ken was the first internally developed one.
Oh, really? By Square Enix, right?
Yep.
That's after the merger. And of course. And for some reason, I didn't know this before, but Enix comes from Phoenix in ENIAC, ENIAC, one of the first computers. So if you're wondering what Enix is, that's what it was. I thought it was Enix for a long time.
As a kid,
maybe
I said Enix.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's – I don't know. I think it's Enix.
It's not a – there's not a Phoenix flying through the sky, but we can talk about that later. I'm sure people will complain no matter how we say it. So who else is on board with Dragon Quest? We have Koichi Sugiyama. He's an old-timer, guys. He was born in 1931, for Christ's sake.
He's a problematic character.
He strongly believes that Japan did nothing at all that was bad in World War II.
That's not the most important thing about his life, of course. And
No, but that's it, that knowing that makes it hard
him.
To.
Yeah. I guess we can talk about that. I mean, like, I find his beliefs inexcusable, but considering the fact that he was like a teenager during World War II, I can understand where those beliefs come from of a losing country.
Yeah, I mean, you have to keep in mind that he's basically our grandparents' age,
like even great grandparents' age at this point. He's
for some people, but yeah, he's an old guy, and of course, we know him best for him denying war atrocities, not his music. But how Enix found him, he apparently played one of their shogi games, for a microcomputer. He sent in a comment card like, hey, I'm this famous composer. He didn't say that, but he signed his name. They're like, oh my god, it's this guy that does music for like anime and TV and stuff like that. Yeah, so they recognized him and they brought him on board. And his first his first soundtrack for the company wasn't Dragon Quest, but he had been working for them before Dragon Quest. And interesting facts about this guy, he was the first guy to record video game music with a live orchestra. and the first guy to basically have a video game music concert, and they were both Dragon Quest. So Dragon Quest helped spark the whole orchestrated video game album thing that is like a pretty much an expected thing with a lot of big soundtracks. Like, you know, if it's not already orchestrated, like, when's the arranged version coming out? And that's something that kind of started in this Dragon Quest era. And then, of course, we have Akira Toriyama. And if you're not a weeaboo like us, we should probably tell you that he is the Dragon Ball Z guy. But before that, he did Dr. Slump and Dragon Ball. It was always called Dragon Ball in manga form. And if you don't think he's a good artist or a good writer, check out his early stuff, because that was before his soul was crushed. And he had a lot of talent and creativity before
old,
he became
old
a
Dragon,
slave.
Or old Dragon Ball is amazing.
It's it's beautiful.
And he was a humor – he's a gag comic artist who got kind of – accidentally became an action or martial arts guy.
Yeah, the second he made his first like jokey fighting tournament in the Dragon Ball series, they're like, this is what sells. Make more of these tournaments. And he's like, oh boy, what did I do?
I just wanted to make up Jackie Chun and have him punch guys.
And have a pig that has a diarrhea on command. That's what Dragon Ball is all about.
And a lot of peeping.
Yeah. So Hori basically uses Shonen Jump connection to get Toriyama on board. That's collusion, folks.
Collusion.
And I guess there's some old Tumblr posts I saw that basically Hori would like sketch out a monster design and he'd send it to Toriyama. So this Tumblr post I saw, and I think Jeremy, you saw it as well. You might have shared it. It's like Hori's like weird version of a Drakey or whatever, and then it's Toriyama's like version under it. So he sketched out like what the monster should look like and things like that. So
that's still how he works. He still comes up with. Pretty much – Hori comes up with the ideas for pretty much every enemy that appears in the games and doodles them, and then Toriyama's like, let me make that look good for you.
Let the artist
Hori
do his job.
He's got kind of a weird relationship with the series because he's not, you know, a developer himself. He doesn't really get down and dirty with the programming. That's always been someone else. But he's very deeply involved with the scenarios and with the designs and characters and everything.
Yeah.
At this point, he still seems plenty involved in the franchise, like way more hands-on than pretty much anybody from his generation other than, I guess, like Kojima.
And Miyamoto. They're around the same age too.
He
is like – look, reading old Japanese interviews, there is this guy called the planner who's essentially the director, and he's like the idea guy, the guy that gives things to programmers. Like, this is what I want in my level. This is what I want it to look like. And like Miyamoto and Tezuka basically drawing like levels and giving them the programmers. Essentially, that's what a planner does. Like, he doesn't actually do the grunt work, but he tells programmers like what he wants the game to be. And essentially, that's what he did with Dragon Quest One. Reading some interviews, I read Christian Nutt's really good interview with him from 2011, I believe, the 25th anniversary. And apparently, he wanted to make the PC RPG experience available to people that had a Famicom, because back then, microcomputers were very expensive devices, probably like over $1,000 at the time, not accounting for inflation. But he also wanted to make it accessible. You know, things like Wizardry and Ultima are pretty hard games if you don't know what you're doing. And even if you do know what you're doing sometimes, Dragon Quest is really straightforward. And he wanted something for that Famicom crowd that would have the same like hooks as an RPG, but something a little more accessible than, you know, the things I mentioned earlier that are huge influences on Dragon Quest. And what are some of those influences, Jeremy? Can you talk about like what was borrowed to make Dragon Quest? I find it fun that like these things that are so Japanese in our minds are really just drawn from Western influences. Like anime, of course, is like Max Fleischer cartoons. And that's evolved over time to be something different. But this very, very like Japanese RPG archetype or form comes from Western sources. What are those?
Yeah, I mean the biggest influence, direct influence, is Wizardry, which was an RPG series developed by a Canadian company called Sirtec. And the guy who founded – one of the guys who founded Sirtec is now in charge of I want to say manga entertainment. Is that right?
Is that still around?
Robert Woodhead.
They still publish stuff, yeah.
Woodhead. Okay, I thought that was maybe, Anime Ego or whatever.
I think it's Anime Ego, yeah.
Yeah, Ego.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, sorry. Not
Lego
manga.
My Anime Ego.
Yeah. And it's not manga entertainment, it's manga entertainment.
All right.
Remember.
yes.
Anyway, so.
Wait. Manga entertainment, which publishes DVDs, figure that out.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Manga entertainment.
Yeah, sorry, manga.
Manga.
Yeah, so anyway, Wizardry. I believe the story is that Hori and a few other people went to Macworld like 1983, 84 and saw Wizardry running on, you know, Mac systems there or Apple systems, I guess, before Macintoshes, and were like, this is amazing. and they got really hooked on it. And really, RPGs like that, you know, Wizardry, Ultima, were available as import games that came over much later in Japanese, or else you had to struggle through them in English. Hank Rogers, who is better known for bringing over Tetris to Nintendo, developed a game specifically for the Japan audience called The Black Onyx.
That's great. I love
so
that.
So there was – he was a Dutch dude living in Japan, took an American RPG concept, made it for Japan, then brought over a Russian game to a yeah.
I like that the Japanese RPG is invented by a white guy named Hank.
Dang it.
Hank. H-E-N-K. He's Dutch.
And he's like super Hawaiian too.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, they were really strongly influenced by that. The Battle View was influenced by Ultima. And a lot of what they brought into Dragon Quest, I mean, they wanted that RPG experience, but in turning that into a console game, Horii kind of looked at the work he had done with Portopia, the Portopia serial murder case. I can't remember the full Japanese title.
I think that's it.
Say it. Well, yeah. It's like Portopia Rinzoku something.
Oh, no one wants that.
Yeah. Anyway, he had made this graphical adventure for PCs, and that was converted to Famicom and became sort of the first console graphical adventure game. It was a detective novel.
Yeah.
Kind of like very much in the sort of MacVenture style of game, more so than King's Quest or, Police Quest or something like that. It was much more of like a menu system. And he took that and said, what if I could turn this into a combat system? I mean, I don't know if that's actually what his thought process was, but it certainly seems that way because Dragon Quest battle lineup, like the battle viewpoint, is very menu-based, very simplified. I mean, in the first game, you have the ability to fight, and you have like 8 magic spells you can cast at the end of the game. And that's pretty much it. You can run. It's not a complex game, but it draws very heavily on the windowed view and the controller-driven menu input system that he used for Portopia.
Yeah. I think it's important to point out that he also, like, along with being credited for, I guess, inventing the JRPG or whatever you want to call it, like, making this form, he also kind of invented the, like, detective mystery game, mm-hmm. like the menu-based
one. And that was a really big deal.
It was before MacVenture. It was the same year as King's Quest.
Yeah.
And it was, like, riffing on Mystery House, Zork, things like that. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any other precedents or predecessors.
I mean, I'm just saying that became a really big deal in Japan, kind of like Dragon Quest clones. Before everything was a Dragon Quest clone, everything was a Portopia clone.
Yeah, watch Nintendo.
Nintendo had its Famicom Tante Club. There was the Jake Hunter series from Data East. I think there were a couple of others. There were those terrible Toachiki Sherlock Holmes games.
Yeah, with like action segments in them. Yeah. Watch Crontendo, the first couple years of the Famicom, or the first 3 or 4 years, is a lot of Portopia clones.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah.
I need to look up I want to look up a fan translation now of Portopia, because I didn't realize its importance in history as well.
Oh, yeah.
Until just now.
You haven't been reading my retrospective, son.
There's a lot of things to read on the internet.
Putting Henry on the spot.
It's full of text.
It's been translated. So Horii's philosophy on the series, and this comes from the interview with Christian Nunn, he said it's like climbing a mountain. If you keep trying, you'll be rewarded with a great view once you get to the top. And that's kind of what all Dragon Quests are like. Like, if you keep playing the game, you will eventually finish it. You just have to keep playing because you will eventually get stronger. Just keep at it and you will beat the game, which is a cool philosophy to have, especially at an age where games were just very arcadey or either arcadey or impossible. Like, there either was no end or was impossible to reach the end.
Yeah, that's definitely some place that the series diverged from Wizardry, because Wizardry was very unforgiving. It's, you know, that first-person dungeon crawler style where you roll a party and then you go out into the dungeon and there's a pretty good chance that your party is going to be wiped within like 2 or 3 battles and that's the game over. Sorry. And the Wizardry series actually doubled down on that as it evolved. Like, each Wizardry game was really only something you could beat if you took a save file from the previous game, having won the game, and brought your party in. And then there was Wizardry 4, which is infamously probably the hardest RPG ever made, where you play as the villain trying to escape from the dungeon, and it's full of like teleporter mazes, and there's like this real time element where every move you make, there's something that's closing in on you, And yeah, it's just like an FOE? Super hard, super hard. Not exactly like that, but it's basically like a time limit where like you have X number of moves and then something's going to kill you.
Yeah, my experience with Wizardry is just playing it for 20 minutes and getting killed and having to start over and being like, I don't care about this anymore.
And, and Dragon Quest, yeah, Dragon Quest really took a much more forgiving approach. It thrust you into combat. Like the first enemies you fight are slimes. If you bite off more than you can chew, if you try to cross a bridge and all of a sudden you're fighting a skeleton who kills you, it's not game over. You get sent back to the king where you started the game and he's like, well, you really blew it that time, Dragon Quest hero guy, but that's okay. You get another chance. By the way, I've taken half your money.
Yeah, that's a tax. It does. They do tax you and – yeah, you kind of feel guilty. It's like, but I'm the descendant of Erdrick. I should do better than this.
That's something that still persists. You still get that penalty, although there are many ways to save the game now.
Yeah, you can mitigate it now by putting money into the bank, although even that has limitations. You have to save in units of increments of 1,000 gold.
Oh, right, yeah.
So at the beginning of the game, it's still kind of an onus on you because you're not making 1,000 gold at a time. Like that's a lot of money at the start of the game. Mm-hmm. So you really have to be careful and cautious about how you play. But you keep all your experience when you die. And if you just keep fighting slimes for hours and hours, eventually you won't have to worry about slimes anymore. And then skeletons and then drakies and then golems. Like they will all fall before you if you just keep throwing yourself at it.
Keep climbing that mountain.
Yep.
So before we get started talking about the actual games, real quick, I just want to know where everyone discovered Dragon Quest. For me, it was the infamous Nintendo Power deal. Like, I didn't get it, but my friend got it. And at the time, that was an amazing deal. Like, $20 will get you a subscription to a magazine and a free video game. At a time, for me, when a video game came to you, like, twice a year, like a birthday or Christmas thing, maybe you can, you know, weasel another one out of your mom or dad, you know, at another point of the year. But that was amazing. Like, that was my first encounter with an RPG. It was, like, completely mind-blowing to me. I'm like, okay, you select things. There's no direct action. Like, even though it was Alien, I found it really fascinating. And that kind of sparked my love of RPGs that it worked. It worked on me, that plan that Nintendo Power had to get American kids interested in RPGs. It didn't work as well as they wanted it to.
Yeah, I don't think that was really their plan. I think their plan was, like, you would get interested in RPGs from reading about them, and then you would go buy the RPGs.
Yeah.
But then when no one bought the RPGs, they were like, why don't you have this RPG as an incentive for
we published way too many of these, so here's the surplus. Yeah, I also profited from that surplus too, but I think I did borrow it from a friend as well because I remember them giving it to me and giving me the warning of like, you're going to just kill a lot of slimes. I'm going to tell you that right now. And yeah, I was super into Dragon Warrior, though it bordered on too hard for my 8-year-old brain at some points. But I stuck with that one to the end. I didn't beat any other NES Dragon Warriors, but that one I did stick with all the way to the end. And yeah, it was just beating and the playing over and over and over again. But you got a lot of bang for your buck from that one.
For sure, yeah. Jeremy, did it reach you the same way?
I was one of the weird people who actually got the game before they gave it away. It was a Christmas gift from my grandparents, which actually meant my parents bought it. My grandparents had no idea what was going on. And I think if they were super Christian, so if they had known about it, they would have been like, wait, it's the devil.
You're fighting evil,
but
Jeremy.
They would have been happy that the crosses got turned into like tridents or whatever.
Yeah.
I guess.
Anyway, it's not sacrilegious.
Yeah. So yeah, I actually ended up getting the game, a few months after it came out as a Christmas gift. And my first impression was like, oh, this is kind of weird. But, you know, within a couple of hours, I was like, oh, this is great. This is really cool.
Was that your first RPG experience, or did you have prior RPG experiences?
It was my first proper RPG experience.
Okay.
I had seen people playing RPGs on like TI computers or whatever. And I had played sort of like some proto-RPGs that had come out on NES, if you want to consider Zelda an RPG.
Sure. Just to make people mad, I will.
And, you know, Simon's Quest and Fazanadu and, you know, games that had leveling systems. So
RPG elements, if
indeed.
You will.
Indeed. What?
So I got the idea of levels and getting stronger and getting better weapons. Like, that wasn't alien to me because I had sort of been eased into that. So, you know, I remember the day after Christmas meeting up with some friends to do work on some kind of school project or something and gushing to them about, like, this game is really cool. Like, it's this huge adventure and you have to go rescue the princess. But that's not the end of the game. You rescue the princess and then you find out there's this whole other quest beyond that. It's awesome. So, yeah, I was into it. But then I never actually played any of the sequels.
They were hard to find because NX
published
them.
It was because, like, the idea of having a multi-character party really seemed alien to me.
Oh, wow, okay.
I know I've mentioned this on Retro before, but, like, the idea of, like, wait, I have to share my gold and weapons and stuff? Like, that seems like a lot of trouble. It's going to be really hard to manage. It'll be, you know, three times as much grinding. I didn't really get the idea of the game scaling with the characters and the party needs, but
so...
So I ended up kind of getting more into RPGs through Final Fantasy than through Dragon Warrior.
That was another big push from Nintendo Power. That one, I think, worked a lot better. But just to let you guys know, we're going to walk through these games in order, try to say something about all of them. We're not going to handle the spinoffs because there are a lot of them. I will say Rocket Slime deserves special mention because those are such great games, and we only got one of them. And, God, it's been 10 years since that game came out almost.
Jeez.
So, man, I miss Rocket Slime. I want to play it. But... we could cover these in a later episode, but for now, let's talk about the main series. So the first game, oddly enough, is called Dragon Quest, and we already talked a lot about some of the aspects of this, so we won't go on too much longer, but this released in May of 1986 in Japan and August of 1989 in the United States, which is one of the reasons why it didn't set the world on fire in America, even though they made a lot of changes to this version.
They did modify it a lot.
Yeah.
Quite a lot, yeah. When I first saw pictures of Dragon Quest comparing it to Dragon Warrior, I thought, wow, I thought Dragon Warrior was primitive.
Yeah. And like in the previous versions, your character did not face any other directions. He just kind of like scooted along and like strafed his way around townspeople. And this game didn't even have battery backup when it first started. It was released for the MSX and the Famicom and some microcomputers. And it had the Imperial Scrolls of Honor, which is the way you save your game. That was just a password. So I can't imagine how long that password must have been. Oh, dear God.
Probably like River City Ransom.
Yeah. Maybe it made a haiku or something. Who knows?
So we mentioned people who played an important role in Dragon Quest's conception, but we missed Koichi Nakamura.
Okay, please go on. Is he a Chunsoft
the
guy?
The founder of Chunsoft.
Okay,
yeah.
Awesome. Please
and
go
he kind of had a story similar to Yuji Horii, where he was someone who came into Enix's, I guess, circle of influence through a contest. He created a game called Door Door, which was like a puzzle platformer, action-y kind of reminds me a little bit of Wrecking Crew or Mappy by Namco.
It's like a single screen arcade game.
Yeah,
with like a
yeah.
black background.
And you have like doors that you have to open up so creatures will go through them and kind of vanish into the backside of the stage where they can't hurt you. Anyway, that was a pretty big hit. NX published it and it ended up being ported to tons of systems, including the Famicom. And when it came time to create Dragon Quest, Horii worked with him and Chunsoft because Nakamura also was a big fan of RPGs. And he loved rogue-style games, which is where Mystery Dungeon came from. The whole Mystery Dungeon series started as a spinoff of Dragon Quest. And that was Nakamura kind of like making his own RPG. But Chunsoft developed the first five Dragon Quest games. They did the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And Nakamura was heavily involved in the programming and design of Dragon Quest 1 and 2, and then starting with 3, the games became much bigger, so he kind of took on more of an advisory role. But he was involved in, you know, pretty heavily in the first 5 and then the spinoff of 4. And so I, you know, even though they're not involved, Chunsoft isn't really connected to Dragon Quest anymore. I think he had a pretty big role to play with the beginning of the series. And also Satoru Iwata was did the reprogramming on the American version of Dragon Quest.
I think everyone just discovered that recently.
Yeah, I was sad to find out. Well, I was amazed to find that out, but I was sad it took, you know, his passing for me to learn that information. I didn't know that either, and I consider myself a big Dragon Quest fan. But Iwata seemed to just be like the fixer or like the wolf from
cleaner.
Pulp Fiction. Yep. Just to show up like, this doesn't work, and you just like do it or whatever. He made it work, and apparently he was a big help on the localization aspect of Dragon Warrior, which – for its time, a lot of people look back on it as like an amazing localization.
It was. It was really great. It had personality. It was grammatically correct. And it used archaic grammar. Maybe not. I think Bob probably has some quibbles about that.
Okay. So there are many.
I saw that in the notes.
There are many varieties of English. And I spent way too much money on an English degree to not let this go by. So this is early modern English or Elizabethan English or like Shakespearean English. If this was Middle English, it'd be like Canterbury Tales. If it was Old English, it'd be like Beowulf. So if you need some examples, there they are. But it's kind of written in a Shakespearean way. I don't know if all the these and the thines and the thous check out as appropriate or like grammatically correct. But it is in that kind of I don't think it's a dialect. I think it's just a phase of English or like
To me, it kind of reminded me of how Thor and other Asgardians would talk in Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That same kind of like what – what a geek thinks Elizabethan talking is.
It's like the 6-year-olds playing this or the 8-year-olds playing this won't know any better.
It's very Dragon Warrior is like an RPG as localized by Stan Lee in the 60s.
So a few more things to talk about, like Dragon Quest. We're going to call it Dragon Quest because that's what it is now. But for the longest time until like 2005, it was Dragon Warrior because some pen and paper RPG was called Dragon Quest. That's Intercap, no space. And that's why we were stuck with Dragon Warrior, which is not a bad name.
No.
You're not ostensibly playing as a warrior. I guess maybe in the first game you are. And it's fine. Dragon Quest is much better. Whenever I see DQ, I think of Dairy Queen, but that's my fault.
No, when I tweet about it,
you grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah, that's true.
When I tweet about it too, and truncate it to DQ, like people, I feel like I get at least 2 tweets saying like, "I thought you were talking about Dairy Queen." I could go for a Blizzard right about now.
I want a Mr. Misty.
Those are good too.
Like
not a Dilly Bar.
We all like Japanese games. Oh, Dilly Bars are good too. We all like Japanese games, but no one in this room has called a Drakwe yet, and I'm glad because I would make you leave.
I wouldn't say that. Yeah,
if you did that.
Shane Bettenhausen's the only one who does that.
Yeah, I know.
People are even like when they're talking about Retronauts, they're like, "Who's the guy who always says Drakwe?"
And Tara's name is Tina forever.
I think that was the first time I ever heard it said that way. Was by Shane Bettenhausen on some podcast.
That's for sure. So this game, like we said, it came out about 3 years later than the Japanese version. And by this time in Japan, August of 89, Dragon Quest IV was almost coming out. So like my question for you guys is, do you think that Nintendo could have skipped right to Dragon Quest III and released that? Or would that be like too much for someone who had never played an RPG, like day and night and all these towns and I can choose my party? Oh, my God. Like where do I start?
I think it would have made more sense for them to do that.
Yeah.
But I think that they were being overly conservative because, you know, they had a young audience of kids and RPGs are a pretty complex concept, mm-hmm. especially when you realize I'm not actually doing anything. I'm just like working through menus. So I can see why they made the choice they did.
And I think even if you cut to like 1995 or 6 when Nintendo is trying to introduce Americans to Super Mario RPG, they still think Americans don't get this. Like we have to very carefully explain this to Americans. So I think the simpler the better. Also, I think it might come from the same – us getting the first one comes from the same way of thinking of like when they brought over the original Mobile Suit Gundam show to America, even though it was 20 years old at that point and very few kids are going to like that. they still thought we have to start at the beginning. Like we have to teach them from the start what's cool about this.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, respect that.
Yeah, yeah, I do too. I just wonder if it would have been – I mean Dragon Quest III still didn't look that good for being a 1988 game. It always looked dated until maybe Dragon Quest VI. I think that's when they finally started concentrating on graphics, which is not the most important thing about Dragon Quest, but that is a gorgeous game. We'll get to that soon. But anything else to say about Dragon Quest I? It's a shame that it never caught on here. And this is like – there are like three concerted attempts, I think, to push Dragon Quest on us, and none of them have really worked. And this is the first one. So maybe only two. I'm not sure. Maybe
so,
there are only
two. Yeah, Dragon Warrior – what I remember about it was I remember being really frustrated by – I believe one puzzle is you have to walk a very specific number of steps and then search a tile just to find the thing.
But you have Gwaelin's
love.
Yeah. To say thou must go three steps to the right and six steps north or whatever.
What are you looking for when you do that?
I believe the Orb of Light.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah. It's been, you know, 25 years.
But I guess the Orb of Light.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was that. And also, I believe the game had a surprising thing where you could join the – you could choose at the end to join with the dragon, right?
Yeah.
Actually, Dragon Quest Builders, the upcoming Minecraft ripoff, that is – that apparently
– called it like it is.
It's a ripoff.
It totally is.
I want to play it. Apparently, the premise of that is that you say yes to the Dragon Lord, and then people have to go in and rebuild the kingdom after the chaos that descends.
Jeremy, did you ever make the pun Slimecraft? Was that you?
I did not, but that's a great pun.
I might have just made that up. They should call that game Slimecraft and just go.
No, I did see that somewhere, but unfortunately, that wasn't my clever pun.
So I still think of him as Erdrick, but it's a different name later, right, when they did the Game Boy remakes.
Yeah, Loto or Roto.
Yeah, Roto, Loto.
Loto is okay. Roto, I think Roto Rooter. Like,
Roto Tiller.
I'm the hero who's come to plumb your front yard and keep your septic tank.
Or tear up your garden or something like that. So
I did play through it all the way again on the Game Boy remakes too.
Oh, me too.
The Dragon Warrior 1 and 2, which had like the worst box art of its time.
What was up with the box art of the Game Boy Color one?
Fighting or something?
Well, it was like crummy. It was just like CG goofy. It came from the same school of thought of like bad box art Mega Man. Thinking like
American, it was not that bad.
No. But I'm
it
saying
it was not that bad.
It had the similar intentions of if we give this anime big eyes, Americans won't like this. So let's draw ugly characters.
Yeah.
They'll like that. And I'll talk about with Dragon Quest III how that changed. But anyway, yeah, I played the Game Boy version. I remember being okay with the localization, but and liking the limited. It was one of those Game Boy Color dual ones that could be on old and new Game Boys. Yeah, I think it'd be one that I would much prefer to play the NES version now than visually than the Game Boy version, because they just had to. It's so undetailed and so much smaller. The aspect ratio is
I played a little bit of it and was really turned off by the fact that the map screen is just like, I don't know where I'm going. I can't see anything.
There's not enough
space around me.
At the Game Boy Color's resolution or Game Boy resolution, like a dialogue box can fit like three words before you have to scroll. Yep. So it's like so irritating. But there is a Super Famicom port of this one and two.
The Game Boy Color versions of Dragon Quest 1 through 3 are based on the Super Famicom remakes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So they have a lot of mechanical refinements and a lot of like quality of life improvements.
No more stairs command, right?
Yes,
no more door commands.
There might still be stair commands.
Hmm.
I think there's definitely
They sometimes take that out for the US, though. They keep it in Japan because Japan's like, tradition.
I must click the stair command.
And then I played a tiny bit of the iPhone version, which was okay, I guess.
I must warn people, the iPhone versions of 1 and 2 look so hideous, but the third one is based on the Super Famicom remake and it looks a lot better. But it's still man, I wish those games had better UIs. We got to move on, though, to Dragon Quest 2. There's going to be a big gap between these releases up until they stop being released. So this came out in January of 87 in Japan and December of 1990 in the US. Woof, that's late. And again, like Jeremy said earlier, this is the first Dragon Quest with a party, and the enemies have parties too, so it's not just you squaring off one-on-one with an enemy. Unfortunately, the battle backgrounds go away, which I find to be a real bummer, because you're just like fighting in a void or fighting on the set of the Charlie Rose Show or something.
Yeah, I don't like that fighting in the void thing. I did miss – oh, I meant to mention one real quick with one. Also that I love that – I really did love the menu setup for it, so much so that – when I went to Japan last year at the crap. The Square Enix Cafe that's right next to the Square Enix
the
building.
Dragon Quest Cafe?
Yeah, the Dragon Quest Cafe.
Oh, yeah, the new Square Enix Cafe.
Yeah.
I went one time and it was just playing like the Ultimicia's Castle theme from Dragon Quest Final Fantasy VIII over and over again. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's getting kind of ominous in here.
Yeah.
When I was there, I had slime pancakes and they were set up in the exact like menu setup of the first Dragon Quest.
Did you have to select eat before you ate them?
Well, like they even had like the menus were like chocolate things with the dialogue written on it. The Japanese equivalent of a slime appears.
I want really some novelty cafes to open up in SF. I mean, there's already a lot of other ideas happening here. Why not that one?
Have you been to the actual Dragon Quest Cafe?
No, I have not.
Rita's Cafe in Roppongi?
No, I would really want to, but I have not. I think I keep missing when it's open. But the slime buns.
Slime Nikuman.
Yeah, any kind of food you turn to a Dragon Quest creature looks so much more delicious. I don't know why.
They also have a tiramisu that looks like those – I can't even remember what they're called. They're like these little happy guys. But I guess that's every Dragon Quest enemy. They're so happy to fight you.
The smiling ghost.
Hi, I'm going to kill you.
It's a part of that old Dragon Ball charm. Mm-hmm. So Dragon Quest II, there's lots of changes here. No more torches in dungeons. You can see everything. You can even jump down to lower floors and towers. The one thing I think about this game is Dragon Quest I isn't an easy game, but it's so straightforward. Like you only have to be stronger than the enemies to win. Dragon Quest II, there's a lot more going on. It's a very hard game. And part of that is it's very, very nonlinear. Like once you get a ship, which is a big deal, like it's essentially okay. Find these five things somewhere in the world, and then go to the,
anywhere.
Go to the, yeah, and the hints are vague. Like this is like I never made a lot of progress in it. This is the one that I owned as a kid. I never made that much progress in it just because it is so open-ended at a time when we really weren't used to that. I mean, like Dragon Quest I, you can wander in certain ways, but you're gradually led to where you're supposed to go. Dragon Quest II. It's just the whole world, and I'm sure it's tiny now, but when I was a kid, I was like, oh my god, like I have this boat, and even when I launch the boat, I have to fight enemies on the way, so I have to know where I'm going, and just like – it was like just too much for me to handle, and I think they dialed back on the difficulty with the later games.
Yeah, I think Dragon Quest II is probably the one game in the series for which the climb the mountain philosophy doesn't necessarily work.
You'll meet a cougar at the top or something.
Well, it's that in the late game, there are a lot of enemies who use instant death attacks, and there's not really anything you can do about that. You can't really block it.
No.
You just have to hope it misses. And if you lose a party member, well, got to go back to the church and revive them.
It doesn't help that the two party members that you have are kind of weak. Like they're both magic users.
They join up later.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Secret of Mana where you don't start out with the whole party at once and they don't scale to your level.
Oh, no. They start
out at level one.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of like dragging around these weak people and grinding.
There's a lot to learn
in
this first party game since then. But yeah, it did have the thing that I like seeing in a lot of the sequel trope, which is the continent from the first game is now just like – it's a smaller part of a huge world.
Oh, yeah.
It does the Zelda 2 thing.
Yeah.
We're going to see that.
Same with Advance Wars. I was just playing Advance Wars 2 because it came out on the eShop and it does the same deal too.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah, like that'll be a tradition which gets really cool in the next game. But other things about this, like this is when NX started releasing the games by themselves, which they would do until they closed up shop in 1995. Thankfully, they kept the quality of localization. Only in the U.S., correct. They were like, Americans don't like our games, but we don't like you either, and they slammed the door. And they took all the Dragon Quests with them.
Mutual disrespect.
Yeah, so I mean, like, again, this is probably my least favorite Dragon Quest, even though I should have nostalgia for it. I just remember it crushing me over and over, and like, it's just too hard. I mean, I like the changes it made, which are all very important, like the parties, the multiple enemies, the better dungeons, but it's a very, very tough game to
play. I
think
it also did have that thing where you aim at an enemy group, and if they're all gone, you'll just miss.
Yeah.
Like, that's mean.
You fight groups at a time. And I don't know how long down the road that they eventually – did they ever change that? I can't remember. I think in
– the way you aim at groups or
like,
the whiffing?
You aim at groups. Like, I want to fight –
that's still in the series.
Okay, I thought so. Wow. Mm-hmm.
The games have gotten better about being fair with that. Like, if you aim at a group and there's an enemy that will die if you hit that enemy, you will hit that enemy.
Yeah.
It's not like – You get one enemy in the group down to like almost no health, and then your party members wail on the thing with the strongest health, so you just drag out the fight. They actually – the AI in more recent games is pretty good about saying, all right, let's keep this fight short.
Yeah. At some point if you aim at an enemy that's already dead, you'll just go on to the next one, right? in the series.
Yeah.
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 This one, though.
No, not this one. I didn't beat this one at the time. I didn't beat it until the Game Boy Color remake, which, again, softened a lot of the BS in it.
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah. I still didn't finish that one, though, because it's still hard.
And it did have continuity, too, like, which the between games that the, you know, Final Fantasy and similar games didn't have. It was you were the descendants of the dude who – the main character of the first game. You were the kid of that guy in the country he set up.
Yeah. Don't you meet like the Dragon Lord's grandson or something?
Yeah.
And he's helpful. Just like this dude who's like, sorry about my granddad.
He's a real jerk. So yeah, that's Dragon Quest II. Let's move on to Dragon Quest III, which is my personal favorite of the older games. It's a tie between this and 9 overall for me, but this came out in February of 88 in Japan and June of 91 in the US. For God's sakes, we're coming up on Super Nintendo territory. But again, it's amazing to think that this released before DQ1 in the States because it's so huge. It's so much more advanced. And to me, it feels like a response to Final Fantasy or maybe just the next logical step for Dragon Quest because instead of having prescribed party members, it's like, no, you create your own party and they can level up and you can – it's actually better than Final Fantasy because you can keep the skills and change classes, like which would become like the fundamental building block of this whole job system that we're all obsessed with today, you know?
Yeah, the job system is incredible. I did love the Sage was one of my favorite things. Like you talk about the climbing the mountain thing and playing as the goof off.
Oh, I love that title.
The bunny, like sometimes the if it's a female character, she dresses as the classic like Playboy bunny character that, you know, Rumiko Takahashi would draw all the time. But then you'd play as these characters who are a waste pretty much on your team until then they can be the only one who can be the most powerful class in the game. And I read online that this game caused a state of emergency in Japan and they had to outlaw video games.
Yeah.
So. My uncle who works at Enix told me. I think –
But like, this was when it hit really big. Like this was the biggest – this is when like Dragon Quest arrived.
Yeah,
like,
I mean they had a photo of the pre-order line in Nintendo Power. They were like, Japan loves Dragon Quest.
We won't bring it to you anymore, but hopefully someone else will.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean this game is huge. I mean the job system, again, super advanced for the time, kind of like, you know, basic now, but it was still an important step in that whole job system idea that I love so much in an RPG.
I love job systems so much because I love the grinding, but then this gives you like double grinding to do. You grind all the time with a guy over and over again.
It makes grinding more rewards for grinding, that is. And so another big thing about this game has a day and night cycle, which to me like totally blew my mind as a kid. Like most of the characters, it gives these characters that your NPCs like a real life of their own. They're not just standing in the same places, walking in the same circles, spouting out the same dialogue. They do different things at night. Some of them, you know, just go to sleep. Some of them have like secret lives where they go gamble or drink or carouse with women or whatever. But it was important to like, okay, these people are doing more than one thing. They're more – the world is going on without you. Like things are happening without you shoving them in the right direction, which I really like in these kind of games. And Dragon Quest would not always have a day and night cycle, but in this game it did. And that was a huge thing for me, something that really impressed me as a kid for an RPG.
I will say the my one issue with the – job system in 3 and 9 is that it comes at the sacrifice of characters because they're not – you just hire a mannequin who you dress up as.
That is true.
They're not they're not a person. In 9, they at least – they surround you with story elements, so it doesn't matter that your team members are nobody. But in it still was kind of something that affected it a little bit, especially when you compare it to like – 2 had defined characters in your party. 4 really defines job character.
So, that was huge. So I think there's some other firsts in this game. I'm pretty sure it's the first one with a monster arena, which would become a huge deal. You don't recruit monsters. You just bet on like, will this group of Psyducks fight this group of Drakkis and win? I don't know, but you can bet on them. And that was kind of cool. I mean, gambling, I don't know if this game had casinos too, but I mean, eventually the casino would be a big deal for Dragon Quest. Like, there's always a casino. There's always mods. There's always a way for you to gamble in these
games.
There's
an undercurrent of a love of gambling in this, which made me think that, like, Yuji Horii is just a bit – he has a gambling problem.
Yeah. It's weird that, like – that kind of content was okay, like teaching kids how to gamble, but like Across was like, nope, get that out of here. Our kids will gamble, but they won't look at a little T on the wall.
Though the idea of walking around with like – when your character dies, you walk around with a – with their casket and drag the casket to the church until they can be resurrected. That's some dark imagery there.
Aren't they ghosts in this game or are they caskets? I thought they replaced the caskets because they had little crosses on them. Mm. I think the ghosts just follow you around, but maybe I'm wrong.
Anyway, no bones about it.
Yeah.
Your characters are dead.
They're dead.
No euphemisms.
Yep.
And nuns can bring them back to life if you pay them enough.
Too much money. So this game has a huge, awesome twist.
Spoilers, God.
Everybody. Spoilers if you haven't played this almost 30-year-old game. So at some point in the game, before you fight the final boss, you get pulled into this other world, which you eventually realize is Alefgard. Is that the name of the world from the first game? Yeah, it's essentially like an exact clone of the first game, and you slowly realize that you are the legendary hero that the first
you're Rhodo.
Yeah, you're Rhodo, and the guy in the first game was tracing your footsteps, collecting your armor, and you are the guy who is setting out the Dragon Quest Legends. So this whole like series, this whole trilogy, the first one, it like connects to each other in a really awesome way to the first game. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure I would not have appreciated it at the time or maybe even realized it, but going into this knowing a lot more about Dragon Quest when I played the remake, I was like, wow, I forgot about this. This is so cool. Mm-hmm. Did any of you guys play this game like around release or did you wait for the remakes?
I played it on the GBC.
That's when I played it. Did you ever play this one, Jeremy?
I haven't played that much of it, no. Two and three are my gaps.
The Game Boy Color remake is the best of the Game Boy Color ones, and I have read from on Twitter, John Riccardi from 8-4, who is a Dragon Quest like savant, he says the iOS version of 3 is really great and has an amazing localization. So.
It looks
amazing.
Good.
I don't want to say that, but yeah.
It looks much better than the other mode. I mean, the UI is still trash. That's just something you'll have to face with Square Enix mobile ports. But
Also, the dragon in that game basically is Shenlong from – I mean, they just drew – it looks like they just copied him out of a Dragon Ball comic.
I mean, eventually in this game, the characters do go Super Saiyan when you charge them up. And
there's
like,
also that too.
Their hair turns blonde and they are surrounded with an aura. Like, it's definitely winking at Dragon Ball fans. But, there's a Super Famicom port we never got. It's been fan-translated, as have all these ports been. And it looks really good. It was released around the time of Dragon Quest VI, so the graphics are at that level, which is really great. And, of course, the mobile port is based on that and the Game Boy Color port. So pick your poison. Mm-hmm. They're all good.
Though I will say that that's when the – with the ports and the remakes, the cover art is Dragon Ball Z-style Toriyama instead of – Dragon Ball Toriyama, which you really need, like the squat characters fit way better with the world design of of Dragon Quest.
I feel like Toriyama can't draw like that anymore, and he hasn't been able to since the 80s.
His assistants can't draw like that. Whoever
that could be it too. Yeah.
I think he just that's the way his style evolved. But also one other thing about Dragon Warrior 3 on the Game Boy Color. I really enjoyed that too. Like, I must have put 90-something hours into it just trying to – I wanted to – they have a mean thing in it of – it has the metal system in it. And if you want to get to the extra super, super-D, super-secret dungeon, you need gold medals of every monster in the game. And that's basically impossible to do without grinding for 100 hours.
Yeah.
I think I got about halfway there and then I realized I was losing my mind.
That's good.
What is the requirement for getting a gold medal?
It's randomness. It's just like keep fighting and eventually they'll drop a medal. If you can get silver medals and those come with more frequency and you can – I believe it was three of those can be traded for a gold version. But yeah, it was just it was a mean thing to make people play it forever. Though it also had the I guess you'd call it like the Fortune Street Alpha or whatever, and it has its own like board game in it. Mm-hmm. And I always love those little board games they put in Dragon Quest.
Those would eventually make it into the remakes, but I don't think they showed up until God, I don't know which game, but we'll get to that soon.
Yeah, I played it in the remake. And I would say that the cover art for Dragon Quest Dragon Warrior 3 on Game Boy Color, they had a vote on it, I remember, because I participated in like NX website was like, do you want the Japanese cover art? And it was an overwhelming yes. And so, yeah, came out with – like they needed to be told – At this point, when the point that came out, Dragon Ball Z was probably as big in America as it ever was.
Oh, yeah,
they,
yeah.
They like, needed to be told, like, if you had Dragon Ball style art on it, Americans will like that.
You're going to fool lots of people. Come on, guys. And we're back from break, and we're going to pick up with Dragon Quest IV. Now, I think by this point, the Dragon Quest like mechanics were all figured out, essentially. So from this point onward, at least for the next two games, you're going to see they really are experimenting with storytelling. And this is like a huge experiment for an RPG in that you are presented with these four playable short stories. And by short, they're pretty substantial. Like, I think they increase in length as you go along. Mm-hmm. Like, they're hours long, so I'm not trying to undersell it or oversell it, rather. But, yeah, like, you're not introduced to the standard Dragon Quest hero until you meet all these characters, and, like, there is a, like, they're tangentially related, like, oh, something bad's happening in the world, but I don't think you really understand, like, why you're playing as these characters until you play as the hero. Am I right in that? It's been a while since I played this game.
Yeah, you have a very brief prologue where you meet the hero.
That's only in the remix, though.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I never played the wow. NES version.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, basically, it's a bunch of vignettes, and then once you play as the hero or heroine, you...
Oh, yeah, it's important. This is the first Dragon Quest where you can choose a male or female main character.
It makes no difference to the story.
The SJWs got to them in 1990, huh?
Right. Makes no difference to the story. It's essentially the same all around. It's just a different sprite. But, yeah, once you play the hero or heroine, then you start meeting all these people whose stories you've already experienced in small pieces, and you pull together a party. So basically it's taking – okay, so you know the original Dragon Quest, you had – the hero. That was it. It was a one-person party, as to say. Dragon Quest II, I think, took an interesting approach to creating a party because you did not start out by rolling a guild. You did not create your party at the beginning like you do in every other RPG to that point. They were characters who existed in the world, and you met them and brought them into your party along the way. Dragon Quest III was more like the guild system. But then Dragon Quest IV went back to Dragon Quest II style and basically said, okay, so you're meeting these people in the world, but what's up with them? Like, what's their story about? So it gave you a chance to kind of get some context. So you cared about these people before you pulled them into your party, and you would have your favorites, and you would understand their combat efficacy and that sort of thing. It also meant that you didn't have to bring characters into your party who were at level one and spend time training them up. I feel like it was a practical, sort of pragmatic solution to the problem of Dragon Quest II, which was, hey, I just got the Prince of Canuck, and he's level one, and I'm level 20, and oh my god, this is going to be so boring for the next hour while I train him up. So you met people who had already been adventuring, had already been exploring, who had experience, skill, good armor, good weapons, magic spells, etc. So you created this sort of fully formed party en route, and you got to know the characters, and each of them were very different.
Yeah, and cool that well, mechanically speaking, and you can continue after this, but mechanically speaking, it's like here's a fighter and a healer. Here are two fighters and a magician. Like they gave you different configurations, and they built those chapters around those configurations, which they really couldn't do before. I mean, like once you had your party in Dragon Quest II, you had your party, but here was like, let's try this setup and see what you do with that. And from then on, once you get the whole party, you can decide who you want in your battles.
Yeah, the sequence is. You start with Ragnar.
Yeah, he gets the healing slime. The first monster to be in a Dragon Quest party.
Right.
Yeah, important. And I love that guy.
Healy the heal slime.
Yeah. Healy the heal slime.
He's like, we're not all bad.
Who wants to become human.
Yeah.
And the second character is Elena, right? The Tsarevna.
I think so. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Dragon Quest IV, the DS version, everyone has like – I think they went a little overboard.
I love it. Renaming. It's so corny.
By the time you get to Torneko, you have to read his dialogue out loud to understand what he's saying because it's all like isn't that Scottish? Is he the Scottish?
No, Ragnar
character?
Was Scottish.
Okay, whoever the Scottish one is, it's just like I literally have to read it.
It's a hard pill to swallow at the beginning because the very first dialogue is like the king saying, "Oh, we got to go about the barons and find the You're like,
lots
what?
Lots of wee barons, lots of boots.
Well, I mean, the localization.
Torneko actually has a pretty standard dialect.
What is his? Is he like?
I guess he's supposed to be Middle Eastern.
Okay, yeah,
like
you're right.
Egyptian. Yeah, but yeah. He doesn't really have any kind of unique dialect.
I guess that's a stereotype he's fulfilling of just like the Arab salesman type dude.
Yeah,
selling you carpets and shit.
And that's an important chapter. Sorry to interrupt you, Henry. That's like essentially like let's like. What is an RPG like from the NPC's point of view? And that is so cool. Like,
it's a great little comedy. I do love his chapter. I think is my favorite.
Yeah, he's such a different character than you've ever seen in an RPG. Like mechanically, he's a goof off, but
that's true.
Yeah,
that's his class.
So if you this is a digression, but
I
hope you don't mind.
A class too.
He's
like a mix. He's hybrid. No, please.
But to me, the evolution of Dragon Quest on NES really parallels the first four Final Fantasies, where you start out with like kind of the fundamental game, and then the second game expands on the ideas a lot and gives you a fixed party and it's really hard. And the third game goes for the job system and it gives you generic characters and is really more about the play systems and everything. And then the fourth game takes all the party concepts from the third game and turns those into standalone characters.
That is cool.
Each character in Final Fantasy IV, each character in Dragon Quest IV is a stand-in, you know, like a proxy for a class concept in the previous game. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting that those games kind of did that evolving at the same time. I mean, Dragon Quest IV and Final Fantasy IV came out around the same time in Japan.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like, you know, the one was looking at the other and saying, oh, that's a good idea.
I think it's lateral.
And then the fifth game, like, they totally went different directions.
Yeah, that's where the big break is.
Anyway, all of that is to say, like, Torneko is kind of like a cross between merchant and goof off. Mm-hmm. And, like, on his own, he's not that helpful. But you don't really fight as him on his own very much because most of the time he's in the shop selling weapons and stuff. You go out adventuring to find better weapons and stuff. So there is kind of this dungeon exploration combat element, but it's not the thrust of what Torneko is about. He's really about running a shop and kind of like realizing his dreams and supporting his family. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a different kind of approach to an RPG. It really stands out.
He was such a mature character too in that, like, not that he like was covered in blood and guts and was having sex all the time.
No, like you actually mean mature.
Yeah, as in he had a wife and kids and had domesticity. That's what he was more interested in. I'd also say the big difference in Dragon Quest IV and Final Fantasy IV is that none of the characters in Dragon Quest IV die and then come back to life. Like, none of them sacrifice themselves.
It's lighter on melodrama.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's in general Dragon Quest versus Final Fantasy. But, yeah, I liked 4. I kind of – when I played 4 on the DS – I liked the side character so much that once you came back to Vanilla Hero,
I was
really bored by that
boring.
Guy.
He looks like blue-haired Goku or something.
Yeah, I think in general he's the weakest of the Zenith trilogy, which is what 4, 5, and 6 are known as to fans. I think he's the weakest hero by far, like the hero in 4.
Yeah, getting a mute hero after, you know, 4 chapters of characters with personality is kind of like a letdown. In a way.
I did ask Hori about the second trilogy, and he was like, those games weren't really meant as a trilogy.
I didn't think so.
There's some elements in there, but they're not really connected.
Well, they got the Zenith Dragon. He's always there and stuff.
You mean Dr. Agon?
I want to talk all about him when we get to 5. But yeah, that's funny because the only time I got to interview Hori was about this trilogy too. I got to interview him when 6 came out in the U.S. And so, I got insights into this.
Actually, that's when I interviewed him, and then I ended up having dinner with him after the interview.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was like the craziest, coolest thing I've ever done in my career.
I don't mind that name drop because I'm jealous.
it was just interesting because like I did get kind of just a sense of sort of what he's like as a person, and it's very – he's pretty chill.
Yeah, he seems like it. He does.
I mean, he doesn't I love that he just wears glasses. He wears his sunglasses and then like the t-shirt and blazer combo, which is not a Japanese business style at all. And then He's still in interview – in our interview, but also like I just see him make public appearances. He just seems to say whatever he feels like. He just says, yeah, we're making Dragon Quest XI two to three months before the PR people want to ever say
people are
that.
Like, oh, God. We have to rewrite the whole plan.
You've done it again, Yuji. You've done it again. So there are some weird things going on in this game that didn't make it to further versions that I noted. One of them is in the original Famicom / NES version, you only control the hero after that chapter. So everything else is AI, which is an interesting choice. But depending on the NES, to make smart choices is probably a bad idea, so they did change that. But it's cool. It's like, oh, these characters, they're just people you know. You're not controlling them. They're your friends, and they're going to do their own thing. But they quickly decided that was a bad idea, so that didn't make it into further games. And
AI control characters is one of my JRPG pet peeves. Maybe there is – maybe I'll play one that will make me like them, but – like in SMT games,
you're wearing, wearing a Persona shirt right now.
I shut it off immediately in P4. Okay. Like that was actually something we got a review once from a. I didn't get to review the version Golden, and when the review came in, one of the first complaints was, "And you can't control everybody." And I was like, "You got to send this back right now."
Yeah,
this person clearly didn't go into the menu and pick it immediately.
I'm weird. Like I leave that on except for bosses. I don't trust them with bosses, but for random encounters, it's fine. But I understand with Dragon Quest, it was different. Like the programming could not have been that smart to always choose the right thing. And according to some articles I read, it rarely chose the right thing. Like it would waste time with spells you didn't need and things like that. So
it was like the whole party was goof offs.
Yeah, pretty much. And there were some ports. There was a PlayStation port, which I believe the DS version is based on. Mm-hmm. We were going to get that, but the developer Heartbeat, which would eventually develop Dragon Quest VI and VII, they closed their doors. And when a Japanese developer closes their doors, often they're the only ones who know how their games work.
The only ones who knew how to make it again.
Yeah, and that explains why a lot of things don't get localized. Like, oops, sorry, like only we know how to do this and we didn't account for a localization, so you're not going to be able to figure it out. It's like an elaborate puzzle that you don't want to do.
Yeah,
although
the fan translators have. The Heartbeat situation is weird because Heartbeat closed its doors after Dragon Quest VII, Dragon Warrior VII came out in the US and became Genius Sonority. But then...
Oh, it did. Okay.
Whoa, yeah.
What did they develop?
Like the Denpa Men.
Snap. I forgot about that.
Yeah, they do a lot of like sort of very Dragon Quest-ish RPGs, and that's because they worked on Dragon Quest.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently Heartbeat, I didn't realize this until just recently, Heartbeat was reestablished as a company a few years back, and there was some speculation that Dragon Quest XI was going to be built by them, but that's not the case. So I don't know what the deal is with Heartbeat, but...
I do remember when my Dragon Warrior 7 instruction booklet, it has on the back an ad for Dragon Warriors 4 for the PlayStation. You're going to get to play it. Which, imagine playing Dragon Warrior 4 in like 2002 or 2003
on the PlayStation. Yeah.
I think, wasn't there a Final Fantasy Origins or something released in 2003 for PlayStation?
Yeah,
like way after the
or
PS2's
chronology,
life.
Like FF4 and Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, the Chronicles was earlier. I think it was Origins in 2003.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, 1 and 2.
Yeah, so it wouldn't have been totally out of the question. Like the PlayStation was still sort of thriving after a while.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the 4 was built on the 7 engine, right? The 4 PlayStation remake, which is oogly. I do not like the
It's pretty
engine.
Gross.
Good battle sprites, though.
Yeah, definitely.
But the DS version was great. When they announced the DS trilogy, like that I think was when I was happiest as a Dragon Quest fan in America, because they announced 4, 5, and 6 on the same day and just saying, like, we're going to bring all three to America. You're going to get them all. Aren't you excited?
That was a great day for Dragon Quest. And that was like the first kind of – I mean, well, we'll
it's
get to
all
8.
Downhill since then.
Yeah. So now we're going to talk about Dragon Quest V. Again, so this is 92 in Japan and never in the United States. Well, not really. It came out in 2009, 17 years later for the DS. But again, all the mechanics are in place, and this is just another experiment of storytelling in which you play the entire life of a hero from beginning to end.
But not the hero.
Yeah, not the hero. Oh, man, I forgot about that.
That's the important detail.
Please go on, Jeremy. I said Jeremy can spill his guts about this. You've written about this game a lot.
I have. So, yeah, like narratively is really where Dragon Quest V stands out. I mean, it did some pretty cool mechanical things, like with the randomized monsters who would join your party. But really where Dragon Quest V stands apart is in its story, which tells the life of, you know, a protagonist, the protagonist, the hero of the game from start to finish. But he is not the legendary hero. Mm-hmm. And the question is, who is the legendary hero? And eventually by the end of the game, you find out. But, you know, for a while, it looks like it's going to be sort of the standard RPG story. And you go to claim the legendary weapon or whatever. But then it's not you. Like it
you
turns out, wait, I'm just a dude. And so it's kind of like this shock of cold water. And then there are two points in the game at which something terrible happens to the protagonist. And like you have this huge time skip and he loses entire portions of his life. And one of them is just absolutely crushing. I don't really want to talk too much about it because I really feel like people need to experience it for themselves. But in terms of emotional impact, it's right up there with the first 10 minutes of Up.
Yeah.
Totally.
It is really heartbreaking.
And yeah, his life sucks.
Like, yeah, you're like, man.
He goes through so much suffering and it makes things feel even more earned too.
Right. And so when he does get married and, you know, you choose either the – in the remake, it's like either the snooty rich girl or the kind rich girl or your poor childhood friend. Like it's kind of a hard decision. You're like, oh, there's, you know – There's benefits to any choice I make, but I think most people end up going with a childhood friend because it just feels right.
I chose
That's the story it's told. Well, I think you even meet a dude who is supposed to marry the nice rich girl.
Right.
You meet that guy. I felt that was the game really telling you, like, the real way to do it is to marry your childhood friend. Also, it made me so sad to think that, like, some people could actually kill your pet. Like, when you first meet that the saber-toothed again, you can kill him like in a battle. If you don't convince him, like you can kill him. I don't think he's like a story important dude, at least in the DS version. I don't believe so. And yeah, it's got monster collecting.
It's terrible.
And I think Lodja is like one of the best villains they've ever made. Like, because pretty much every game, I think every Dragon Quest game just ends with like, you're fighting this big mean guy and he's evil and he's got eight forms. Well, who is he?
Looks kind of like Dracula sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, they did a good job with Proto Sephiroth in the Dragon Quest IV remake. They put in a lot of flashbacks.
Yeah.
Like you an extra chapter about the character.
Yeah.
I forgot about that guy. Yeah.
His final evolutions are amazing too. The way that battle evolves is so great.
Yeah. The 2D art in these is great. Just the way the enemies look and they animate, and they even have idle animations. But
Dragon Quest V's villain definitely like you want to stick it to him at the end.
Yeah. Oh,
when you
man,
finally
dude.
When you finally figure out who the legendary hero actually is, you're like, I'm going to destroy you because you made my life hell.
It's an awesome game. There are elements like monster collecting or monster recruiting, sort of like Pokemon style, not as explicit, not like there's not a command to catch the monster. They just join your party if you beat them in a certain way, or just randomly they join your party.
Yeah, just randomly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have no way of predicting, and it can totally change how you play the game. Like I ended up recruiting one of those goodie bags, the living bags of treasure.
Oh, yeah, those
guys.
It's
the most amazing monster. It does very little damage, but it's like as high a defense as you can possibly get. It's like 256 defense.
That's amazing.
So I ended up – there were a bunch of like really tough advanced boss battles that I ended up beating just because – everyone got wiped out except the goodie bag, who would just like sit there and take like two or three hit points of damage and then – kind of randomly cast a spell or whatever. Like the battles would last forever because it would sometimes obey and sometimes not. But you know what? It was great. It was my little bag of treasure. It was my treasure.
And you mentioned Dr. Agon, I really liked him too. In the localization, he's written kind of like Ned Flanders. Like he's basically a Ned Flanders,
a little bit,
like
yeah.
super friendly type. And I liked going on that minecart adventure with him. He was fun. I don't know.
And, that was cool.
Yeah. And yeah, I also there's some time travel-y elements to it that in a lot of – there's several elements in that game that definitely remind me of Chrono Trigger. They make me think like that I don't know. It makes me think that this gave him, Hori, some inspiration for scenario he'd go on to do.
The next two games have a lot of that Chrono Trigger cause and effect relationship.
Like six is very – like you can tell that was made contemporarily with Chrono Trigger.
The lead in six may as well be Chrono's brother. Like he's his twin brother.
I mean that's when Toriyama can only draw one face and one hairstyle at that point.
Well, he can – Taimo.
Taimo and Chrono.
No, he can draw two faces, Vegeta and Goku.
Oh, that's right.
Two faces.
Angry – pinched face and happy pinched face.
And also girl face.
Oh, girl face. Bulma. Yeah. Every girl is Bulma. Although Chrono Trigger has Bulma and Aurelei from Dr. Slump. So there you go. All grown up.
Stretching his range there.
We have to move on. But I will say I never use the monster recruiting because once you get your kids in your party and your wife, it's like I want to fight with my whole family. Like why do I want some weird slime with me? I want to fight with my kids.
Well, that's like the last third of the game. So.
That's true. I guess you don't get your kids until later.
Yeah.
Yeah. They got to grow up. So yeah, there's a PlayStation 2 port, never came over here. That's been fan-translated. It looks really cool, has an orchestrated soundtrack, but we recommend the DS version, of course, because you can buy that, and it's a great Dragon Quest, so please play that one.
The PS2, this is another digression, sorry, but the PS2 version is one of the, like, it inspired one of the coolest things I've ever seen, which was someone at a shop in Akihabara put it for just running on a display at a shop. And people would come by and play for just a few minutes at a time. And progressively over the months, they actually made progress into the game.
Wow.
So it was like this collaborative effort to play everyone's favorite RPG.
No one was rude enough to delete the save or anything.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
That's great.
It was you know, it was like that game is about family and it was everyone pulling together.
The country worked together to beat Dragon
Quest
V.
It was a little heartwarming.
I totally believe if we had gotten 5 on the Super NES here, like American fans of the time would remember it just as well as Final Fantasy III.
I think so.
And Chrono Trigger. Yeah.
But again, NX chose to release Brain Lord and Paladin's Quest and
they were
things like that.
Oh, what are we doing? Let's get out of here.
And apparently they spent a lot of money on that King Arthur game, which is an original American release, and it's like, oh, that failed too. So they – God, I wish they would have stuck around because we missed some good games. Like Dragon Quest VI, which came out in 1995, a terribly late Super Famicom game. It cost like – We should mention
terribly.
No, I mean N64 wasn't out by that point.
I guess that's true. Yeah,
it was still the prime of life.
It's still pretty late. And like reading about these games, you realize like these RPGs were like boutique items. Like I was reading, this game cost like $110 in Japanese money at the time, not accounting for inflation. So probably like close to $200 today or something like that.
Yeah, I mean it was 11,000 yen for stuff like Seiken Densetsu 3 and Dragon Quest VI. I don't know what the exchange rate was back then. It was not.
I think it was under a dollar for 100.
Yeah, I think it was probably like an $80, $90 game, which was kind of what Chrono Trigger was selling for here.
So. Or Phantasy Star 4.
Yeah, so not really totally out of line. It's just, you know, you look at it – if you looked at it 5 years ago when the yen exchange rate was just totally off balance, then you were like, wow, that's a lot of money on a video game.
But yeah, I guess this was the era where Chrono Trigger and like software, et cetera, was like $90 new. Yeah.
And 11,000 yen is still cheaper than buying Gun Gal 2 plus the X-ray porno.
Do you want to see a polygonal model naked? That'll be $100.
So, Dragon Quest VI, that was when, I got to interview Yuji Horii and I asked him, oh, isn't this awesome that it's finally, you know, every version's been released in English at this point? And I think he was like, yeah, that's cool. He didn't seem to care all that much. But
care about us, Yuji, please.
He did mention that in the Super Famicom version, he felt that they didn't have enough guidance. So they add in six a little bit more guidance to – because you have two giant world maps to explore in six, but not a ton of guidance. And so in the DS version, they kind of just create a fortune teller that tells you – you could go over here if you want.
Yeah, there's a very light world, dark world thing going on, but without a lot of visual indicators to differentiate the two, which is an issue. But it's very much like there's like a level of the world underneath the world that you live on, and you have to jump down to it and like fix problems and like restore that world. It's like
Holodom.
What's that?
Holodom.
Holodom?
From one of the Oracle's seasons or Origins.
Oh, okay. Holodrum?
Holodrum, that's
it. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
This is the first game to be developed by Heartbeat. And it is a very, like, the story is very basic, like, you are the hero, et cetera. What they really expanded on was the class system, which I think is not a great class system, but...
They introduced it a little late, I'd say.
Yeah, well, that's a Dragon Quest tradition with the next game, for sure. But it's like...
Well, you say the story is very basic, but I feel like that was really the first Dragon Quest that started focusing on sort of standalone vignettes.
Yes,
and
yes.
That's kind of become the Dragon Quest standard at this point. Dragon Quest 6, 7, and 9 were all very much about these little – like you'd go to a village and you could go out of order sometimes, but you'd find these kind of standalone stories and usually with kind of a sad or monkey's paw ending.
Yeah, like Chrono Trigger did that too, and Yuji Horii wrote that game, correct? Or had a lot of influence
scenario
on it.
I think
Masato Kato did the scenario.
Okay.
What did Yuji Horii do? Sat around and collected money.
He probably advised it at a pretty high
level.
Yeah,
but I mean Dragon Quest IV had that. And let's explain the class system. There are 8 classes, 8 possible ranks of these classes. And if you master 2 classes of a certain kind, you can get the advanced class on top of that. But the thing is, most of this information is hidden from you, especially how you level up your classes. There are no job points. There's no like I don't think there's even a number. It's like fight strong enemies and you will advance in your class. That's basically all the instruction you're given. You're not given any idea of if the enemies are too weak to advance your class. You just have to keep fighting. And
it's very ogre battle.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and when you go into this game, you really need to plan out your plan of attack in advance, and 7 too, because 7 uses the same class system. You have to know like what you're going to do, what your party will be, and go from there. Because you can really work yourself into a bad situation if you're not planning to have like a versatile party. Because a lot of this is in your hands, like in Dragon Quest III, mm-hmm. but you're putting a lot more time into it. You're investing a lot more into building these classes. Yeah, and have any of you played this game? It feels like it's the one that people don't really play or talk about. You did? Okay,
yeah.
Cool. I only just started it. I have to say, like, the remake is great, but the Super Famicom version is just so gorgeous looking. Like, it is probably one of the best looking, up there with Chrono Trigger, up there with Final Fantasy III. Like, this is when they really started focusing on graphics. Like, I felt it was like they wanted to join the graphics arm race with Final Fantasy. Like, it looks so good. I don't know if you guys have seen the Super Famicom one recently, but it looks gorgeous.
Not recently, no.
Yeah, it's fantastic, but... Yeah, like I feel like it gets a little not hate, but kind of people don't regard it as highly. But I'm enjoying
it
so far.
Kind of in the shadow of 5, like 5 is better in pretty much every way. But I also like the I like the Dream World setup of it. I like the intro of the game too. I think it builds the villain in a good way, and it can take some surprising turns too. I do like that.
Right.
5, if I were to tell you to play something, it'd be 5 over 6.
Yeah.
But 6 is still great. I also felt bad for the it wasn't the first one. Nintendo published it, and I remember like getting demoed to me, and they were saying like, "Look, and it's got these like proto Street Pass functions on it." I thought, well, this is cool,
well,
but it assumes everybody
owns.
All the
DS Dragon Quest games did that.
That's true.
So you
can
trade an item or something, or like something like that.
It was made by a culture that assumes everybody has a copy of Dragon Quest in their
and
DS.
Everyone lives on top of each other.
And they're all walking by each other on their way to the train.
Yeah, because no one drives. Yeah, that's Dragon Quest VI. Play the DS version or the mobile version, which is based on the DS version. And I hear that's pretty good too. Let's go on to Dragon Quest VII, which, okay, there's a 5-year gap, more than 5-year gap. This game was kind of in development hell for a while because no Dragon Quest game should take 5 years to develop. But this came out in August of 2000 in Japan and October of 2001 in the United States. And what a story. This was announced for the 64DD in 96. So it was originally going to be a Nintendo thing, but then it went to the PlayStation in 97.
Was it actually announced for the DD?
It was. I found sources that told me that. Yeah,
wow.
It's true. It's,
sources?
It really
you a
happened.
Journalist or something?
I might be. And this is like Dragon Warrior returns to the United States, but maybe we should have skipped this one because it's...
I respect that NX put so much work into it because like that had to be... I would bet to that point it had to be one of the biggest localization projects ever, of a console game.
I think it literally is the biggest Dragon Quest in terms of just the size and like where you can go and who you can talk to. I think
one of the localizers, Doug Dinsdale, posts a lot on Something Awful, and occasionally he has he's dropped some knowledge bombs about the game. I'd have to go back and look about them, but it was very much kind of a passion project for everyone involved.
I hear it was really hard to localize. I think maybe even Jeremy Blaustein worked on it too.
Might have.
Yeah, he's complained about it publicly too, I think.
Yeah, real quick, speaking of the 4, 5, and 6, their localization, 8-4 Play has a whole – I forget the name of the episode, but they searched it out. They have an episode with the guy who like wrote the localization bible for the Square Enix's Dragon Quest game.
Alpha Plus.
Yeah, I think so. But it's really insightful about just the Dragon Quest localization process.
I totally agree. That's a great podcast. Not as great as ours though, which you should like and listen to. I don't have to say that. So this game has a really compelling premise. I can say compelling because I'm a games journalist. That premise is
– don't say visceral.
Okay. I won't say visceral. That premise is the world you start on is just this tiny island. And gradually you by going to the past and writing what went wrong, you can restore the world piece by piece. And so gradually as you play, you jump to the past, fix what was wrong in the past, come to the future. There's a whole new town for you to explore. And there's also like this little town that you cultivate and build by bringing people to. There's some really cool systems. Unfortunately, the pacing in this game sucks.
It's like, hour 40 when you get the job system.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I was trying to be conservative and I put 30, but it might be closer to 40. And like I think I played it for 5 hours without fighting in a single battle. You are just like going through the RPG beginning motions.
The 3DS remake streamlines it a lot.
Okay, I was hoping.
The intro is like that, 2 hours.
I want that so bad. I want it so bad. But yeah, I think that pacing was them saying to the Japanese fans, like, we're sorry it took this long. We'll make sure it lasts forever. Like,
yeah.
The PlayStation only got one Dragon Quest instead of 2 or 3, so this will just be as long as 2 or 3 Dragon Quest
There
games.
Were like 4 Final Fantasies in the interim between Dragon Quest 6 and 7.
They all looked markedly better than this.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't beat this one. This is the only mainline one I've never beaten because I got motion sick. The idea of spinning the camera around your 2D sprite dude, it gave me motion sickness. I couldn't keep playing.
Like I don't think Heartbeat was ready for a game in a 3D world, at least the way that they wanted to render it, because this is an ugly game. I mean,
it's so weird that they made the best looking Super NES game and the ugliest 3D Dragon
Quest. Their skills couldn't translate. And like for a 2000 PlayStation game, think of what came out in 2000, like Vagrant Story, Chrono Cross, that's 99.
Legend of Mana, Saga Frontier 2.
Yeah, like
all these, Final Fantasy 9.
Like yeah, Dragon Quest looks
Square
sorry,
games.
Dragon Quest 7 looks like a PlayStation 1 launch game or maybe like a 1997 release.
It's
not that ugly, but still it's inexcusably ugly.
And there's like ugly FMV in it, which feels like such a leftover of them thinking
It's like the FMV that they made for Metal Gear and then were like, no, let's get rid of this.
Yeah, like all I remember is
that was 1998.
There's a weird like dancing girl or something, like a belly dancer. Like FMV, I don't remember a lot of other FMV, but it looked bad and ugly. Like we have the money to do this, now we have to. It's like no, you shouldn't have done that. But
and yet still, for the longest time, was like the best selling Dragon Quest game ever.
Yeah, and boy oh boy, do I want the stupid 3DS remake. I'm so mad that we didn't get it because this is the perfect way to play a game that's so poorly paced that involves so much back and forth between the past and the present.
But the remake streamlines it so much; it makes it so much more. It changes the balance and the pace, and everything is faster and more accessible. It drops a few story elements, but I think the overall opinion of it is like, oh yeah, this is a much better version of the game.
That's good to hear. Because
and it looks so lovely too.
It looks really good, It finally looks presentable. And like I didn't say this, but in order to go to the past, from the past to the present, you don't just jump into a time machine. You have to go through this long battle-free dungeon, like going through all these hallways. It's not just a simple like, I'm going to jump to the past now. That's part of the pacing problem. You always have to return to that shrine to travel between the past and the present. It just adds more like shoe leather to the game, like more needless walking that you don't
and
have to
Nintendo
do.
And then Nintendo saw that. It was like, that works so well. Let's put that in Zelda, and make the Palace of the Ocean King.
Oh, wait. Which one was that?
Phantom Hourglass.
Oh, Phantom Hourglass. That's right. Yeah. Hey, I don't have a problem with that one. Some people do.
I don't either. It's kind of the same problem where you're like doing the same thing over and over again and it gets kind of tedious.
So that's Dragon Quest VII. If you're going to play, just be warned of everything we talked about. It's ugly. The localization needs help because the people working on it, they might have tried hard, but they're up against a lot. And it is very poorly paced. So if you can if you can read Japanese, go for the 3DS version because I don't think we're ever going to get it. I really don't.
I still think – I want to believe in the post-Bravely Defaults and – Fire Emblem Awakening world that it could happen. But we'll talk about that. I'll say that later in the future of Dragon Quest.
If you kids eat your dinner, you'll get your dessert, which is Dragon Quest VII. The dinner is Dragon Quest Heroes, so I'm not too interested in that. But let's move on to Dragon Quest VIII, which is like, okay, so we had this is the third attempt to reinvigorate Dragon Quest interest in the world. It's the first time it was called Dragon Quest. And again, like with Dragon Quest I, a lot of work went into making this game more presentable to Western audiences. We have they replaced the soundtrack with an orchestrated version. They revamped the UI and they added voice acting. Previously, the other version of the game had none of this. It was standard text with like the little blips and blops when you're like reading it, regular MIDI style music, and you know your standard blacks, like super basic menus. But they were like, let's introduce us with a bang to American audiences.
This was the first Square Enix one. This was the first outside for America. And this was, I believe, this was the first Dragon Quest game ever released in Europe. Like they'd not gotten a Dragon Quest game ever before that, and so or a Dragon Warrior game or whatever, because Enix didn't have a European arm, I suppose. But yeah,
and I think this was like kind of Trojan horsed into people's lives because there was a Final Fantasy XII demo. I don't remember
Square Enix's plan has not changed since game. Like, let's just give a demo. That'll get people to buy it. Yeah. It always works. Always works.
I don't remember if that demo was as different – excuse me, was different from the final game. Does anyone remember that demo?
Yeah, I didn't play the demo.
Okay, yeah. I mean that was like on the cover. And it came in a really nice box, like a really nice like cardboard box with like a big fat manual jammed inside of it. I still have it. It's beautiful. And some other things that happen in this game is like they drop the Elizabethan English. Now it is a much more whimsical like storybook version of British English. So like defense is spelled with a C. Get used to it. There's lots of O's with U's following them. That happens. And we talked about this thing earlier with the DS remakes. But again, there's emphasis placed on accents and characterization through dialects and things like that.
And puns everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Puns. It's like the dad humor game. If you're a dad and you like jokes, play Dragon Quest.
Well, I have a friend who still says, oh, my goodness instead of oh my goodness.
Oh boy. It's like they can never run out of slime puns for the game. It's like the cat puns in Monster Hunter.
I pre-ordered the limited edition of Dragon Quest Heroes just because it comes with a special spear called the Gunir.
Mm. Ooh.
Yeah.
Is that the one that stabbed Jesus in the side? Or?
No, that's, okay. that's Longinus.
It's great at killing angels.
Gungnir is the spear of Odin.
That's right. I'm getting my mythologies mixed up. But
8's amazing.
8 is so great. I think like – oh, please continue, Henry. I don't mean to interrupt
you. No, 8's amazing. And them partnering with Level 5 was such a smart move. Like Level 5 could fix a lot of the problems that 7 have. Like they got good graphics. They know how to make good graphics. They did the storytelling better, I'd say, and they did you'd had actual like real cutscenes that of characters doing stuff. I like that a lot.
Yeah, you can see your characters in battle, which is huge.
And the cities were cities.
Yeah,
like, they were actually areas made, and you're walking. I don't know. I just loved it in a lot of ways.
Like, in terms of what it's doing, it's a very basic Dragon Quest game, but it's trading on scope. Like everything is to scale. You walk out into the world. You leave the city gates. The city is not an icon behind you that's the size of your character. Like you can literally like look inside and see the city you just visited. Like you can see things off in the distance. Like one of the early quests is like go off and find that thing underneath the red tree, and you have to find the red tree and like head there. Just so the game will be like, yes, if you see something in the distance, go to it. It's available. Like we want you to explore this land. And like did you guys play or finish this game? I take it Henry did.
I did finish it, yeah. And it's fucking long.
It is really long.
But it's great all the way to the end. It has a really long ending too, like a very drawn out ending. But I liked it all the way through. And the same with the alchemy system was a really interesting idea. I actually like the alchemy system better, or the is it called alchemy?
It's the alchemy pot. Yeah.
The alchemy pot. I actually liked it better in the rocket slime. In rocket slime,
I forget how that worked in rocket slime.
You just kind of drop two things in a pot, and like, hey, well, we'll make a new better thing, and you can then you just go on Game Facts and see like, oh, this is the recipe for the best weapon.
Yeah, that would eventually be the main focus of Dragon Quest IX, which we probably won't get to, but that was a big deal. The alchemy pot, like making new items.
And it was too bad for 8 that like 8 wasn't. It was another one of those ones where they marketed it so hard, like Square Enix did. a lot of right things in marketing it, but it again, like you could, a year later, you could, or less than a year later, I felt like you could pick it up for $20 at
Best
Buy.
They even had like an early social media thing, like the Dragon Quest Club, and it's like I got a bunch of points by taking a picture of all my Dragon Quest stuff, and like wow. I guess you could unlock things. I think I might have got something for free from them. I forget what it was. This was like pre-Facebook and stuff, so they were kind of screwed, and there was only so much they can do, but. This game, like I said, is really simple. It's really basic. There's no skill system. You have predetermined characters, and you decide like how they grow by leveling up certain like skills that they have, like either weapon specializations or things like luck, things like that. Like there are different categories. And again, you need to go into this knowing like, okay, do I want to just use axes? Because you probably want to dump all of your stuff into axes or mm-hmm. fists or whatever you want to use. It's probably not a good idea to like split your efforts between them.
I think 8 has the best puff puff joke of all the
– Oh, right. Yeah.
Too. I think that was something that came up in my interview with them where I said like, oh, yeah, I noticed the puff puff joke changes from explicitness from game to game. And they say like they have to – They like edge up on a T rating depending on how risque they get with the puff puff.
Yeah, I guess we never talked about what puff puff was, even though I used that in my intro.
Or puff massage. Or...
Yeah, it's like I believe it's when your face is pressed between a woman's preferably huge breasts.
I believe that's it. Yeah.
And in this game, I believe they're like, okay, close your eyes, and then the girl rubs two slimes against your face.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the games, it's a man who does it.
Yeah, the lights turn on, and it's her dad. And yeah. She's like, yeah, my dad gives the best puff puff massage. But I also think in 6 there's a scene where a wife goes to a jail cell to give her husband a puff puff massage.
Wow, that is like the sex act of choice in the Dragon Quest universe.
Everyone's got their conjugal choices.
Yeah.
I think that's in Dragon Ball too. I feel like that's where it was identified.
Probably.
If Hori wanted to make some money, he'd make a puff puff only Vita game, right? Where you are the puff
puff recipient.
I'm shocked
that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Dragon Quest puff puff.
Yeah.
Starring Hatsune Miku.
And for $2,000, you can have naked Puff Puff. But that's in our horrible future we won't talk about. So, yeah, I mean, this was this will be the last game we talk about. But again, this is an effort that failed. Even with the great
– I wouldn't say it necessarily failed. The game sold pretty well.
You're right. It sold well enough to get us the DS remakes.
It was not a blowout success. It wasn't like, oh, now Dragon Quest is as popular in the West as in Japan, but it was a success.
I think they had reasonable expectations for this. At least I hope they did, because like I appreciate all the work they did for this game, because it really made Dragon Quest worth caring about again. Like it was like, here's a great localization, here's great music, we're gonna do everything we can to make this world,
and
like,
it's called Dragon Quest.
Yeah, now it's Dragon Quest.
Yeah.
This is the first real Dragon Quest we got, yeah, like I feel like this is a great way to like reintroduce the series to people after Dragon Quest VII kind of really screwed that up. So it's a shame though, because like I take it Dragon Quest XI is going to be of the same design. Is that what it looks like? It looks like a very level 8 level 5 style game. Yeah,
Dragon Quest XI. That's a whole. I could talk for like an hour on just what an interesting situation it is that. It is the first time – I think it is – they always follow the most popular system, but it's an exclusive to that usually, or at least they're always with Nintendo, or it's just this is only on Nintendo or this is only on PlayStation. So for 11 to be both a PS4 and a 3DS game at the same time at launch, that's just a big change in their marketing values, I guess.
It's kind of a sign that you have to put it on two popular systems in order to – equal sales potential for the most popular system in previous generations.
Even for Dragon Quest.
I'm just happy it's not a mobile game. I was terrified that it would be mobile
now,
only.
As soon as I saw Yuji Horii on stage at the 2013, that's when they showed off the Metal Slime PS4. Was that 2013 or 2014?
That was last year.
Yeah. That was last year. The second I saw Yuji Horii on stage, I was like, okay, they're making Dragon Quest. Like him showing up on your stage just says the next mainline Dragon Quest will be on your system. But it may as well. His appearance announces that. And I've played Dragon Quest Heroes. I played the Japanese version because it, you know, region free PS4. And it's pretty. It's definitely a pretty game. And it's the one of I like it more than most Musou games I played. Well, I only put a few hours into it, but I liked it more than the few hours I played of Hyrule Warriors. So.
Ooh. What's that saying, though? I'm sorry. Well, I mean, we were going to talk about 9 and 10. I will say, like, you don't need us to talk about 9. Go play the damn game. Like, it's one of the best Dragon Quest games.
We got enough about that on that 3DS episode.
Yeah, that's
DS
for sure. Go back to that one if you want to hear us talk about 9 and 10. Like, I always wanted to play it. I'll never get to. And by the no one can possibly bring it out here because of like the weird thing about servers. It's an online game. I just wanted to play it because like even the Dragon Quest hooks would get me into an online game.
Yeah,
at least
and
for
it,
a month.
It even has like total region locking.
IP tracking and stuff like that.
Like if it says, oh, you're from outside Japan, sorry.
We don't want your money. Yeah.
Damn.
Like Final Fantasy 14 got me on board for the Final Fantasy stuff. Like the MMO stuff is fine, but it's like, oh, all the cool stuff that I like in this new context, that's fine. I want to play Dragon Quest X. I never will. It just, you know, life sucks, so I'll have to deal with it, I guess.
Yeah, I was very disappointed that I feel like Nintendo is why we didn't get – like they would have been the ones to publish 7 and 8 and
yeah,
10 here.
10 was a Wii game, like a Wii MMO in 2011, so that's weird. And by the time they could have brought it over, it would have been like
– I guess Nintendo of America just wasn't interested in it, I suppose, and I wonder if they ever will be. And I think we're just going to have to depend on Sony to be the ones to give us 11. I would think it's very possible we just won't get the 3DS version of 11 here.
Yeah.
Even though I'd prefer to play that like to play it in the retro style the whole way through that you can like – because I believe – the preview said you play them concurrently for the opening, but then you have to choose if you want it to look old school.
No, you can switch on the fly. If you use if you use the circle pad, then it's the more contemporary style. If you use the D-pad, then it's the retro style.
That's way cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm so excited about this game, and I hope we get to play it. We have to wrap up, though. We're running over on time, but it's been a great discussion of Dragon Quest. We have too much to talk about. It's a shame that we can't talk about the 9 because 9 is great, but like I said –
just imagine how much more we'd have to talk about if they localized
it. Dear Lord. God. So yes, let's wrap up real quick. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, Twitch, YouTube, and other things as – Retronauts, and please go to usgamer.net to read the blog post for every episode. We tell you what music we use, what links you should read, and everything we talk about that you might have missed if you're not paying attention, but you should be paying attention. Also go to patreon.com/retronauts. That's how we get the show funded. That's how Jeremy flies out here to record. That's how we pay for equipment that's breaking as we speak. And just $1 a month can help us out. You've got a dollar a month. I know it. I know who you are. You've got a dollar. And please keep the reviews coming on iTunes Music Network. Like I said, they don't come in that often, and it'll take you like 30 seconds to write a review. We want to rise through the ranks and defeat the people with big office buildings and impressive paychecks because down with the man. We're the small indie people, right? Yes, so contact info. I'm just rambling at this point. I'm Bob Servo on Twitter. Bob Servo, that is. You can read my stuff at Something Awful and US Gamer. And please listen to Talking Simpsons on the Laser Time Network. I believe by this point we will have Season 2 live to the public. Season 1 is locked behind a paywall. But
let's not promise
bucks,
too much here.
Yeah, I don't know. I could be cutting all this out. Who knows? But yes, Talking Simpsons, please listen. I love doing the show so much. Henry, please let us know who you are.
Well, yeah, and Talking Simpsons on the LaserTimePodcast.com. Network, and so that's what I'm doing now. I'm H-E-N-E-R-E-Y-G on Twitter. Follow that. And yeah, I just do a bunch of regular podcasts for there. And we also have a Patreon, patreon.com/lasertime. That's where we have the Talking Simpsons, the first season behind a paywall, where we just talk episode by episode through every episode of The Simpsons. And season one is a real strange duck, but it's fun to go through. And also, and we do streams of video games every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 3 p.m. on our Twitch channel, Pacific Time. Thursday are Nintendo streams. Those are really fun.
I love them. Jeremy.
And I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter at GameSpite, at usgamer.net. On the side, I do GameBoyWorld.com, where I'm trying to document the complete history of Game Boy, trying to round up all boxes and packaging for scans and photographs. But I've kind of hit the point midway through 1990 where games start getting really expensive to get full in there. Uh-oh. So I may be missing a few. Like Ninja Boy, I don't think I want to pay $800 for a game that crappy. So
it's a wise decision.
So there will be some little gaps, but such is life. Anyway, that's what I do with my free time. It's kind of sad.
Awesome. Well, not awesome to your sadness, but I'm glad we wrapped up. I'm glad we talked about Dragon Quest. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Retronauts Micro, everybody. Have a good one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.